ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
One of the most ambitious projects in human history.
It's almost like the atomic bomb in terms of its transformational effect.
For decades, the breakthrough has been just around the corner.
That would bring our financial markets and electronic commerce to a grinding halt.
Will quantum computers change everything? I'm Jacinta Bowler. Binge the whole series now. Search for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Priya, do you know your cholesterol level?
I do.
But aren't you too young to know your cholesterol level?
He's trying to flatter me.
I think you're older than you are, but I know how you're older you are.
And we should explain to people why you did overestimate my age when we first met.
And you've never forgiven me for it, which is fair enough.
I do know it, though, because of my family history on the paternal side. So I'm aware of what it is and I'm doing some extra stuff.
Yeah, I often wonder whether people should know the cholesterol a bit younger in life so that they can really plan for the future, change their lifestyle and so on. I think we often get too late in the story with cholesterol, don't you think?
Possibly, yes. We're being more aggressive these days, but yeah, there's still a long way to go, I think, in terms of being aggressive with prevention.
Anyway, LDL cholesterol, which is the nasty form of cholesterol that leaves stuff in your arteries, is what we're going to be talking about, and the global burden of disease, in other words, the impact it has on disability and death around the world. It's quite interesting. That's coming up here on The Health Report.
I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri Land.
And I'm Norman Swan on Gadigal Land.
Also on the show, we explore the other side to GLP-1s. And Norman, I think we explore a lot of emerging research and benefits on The Health Report. Today
you
we're
do.
Going to look at eating disorders and potential harms with these medications.
It really is a very dark side of these drugs and probably hasn't had enough exposure. We're going to give it, well, you particularly, are going to give it big exposure today on The Health Report.
Yes.
We're also going to look at a cause of abdominal pain. It's actually quite a nasty cause of abdominal pain. We'll explain more about it later. It's acute pancreatitis. It seems to be going up in Australia in young people. And one of the few conditions in Australia that seems to be going up in people who are advantaged, who are well-educated and so on. Any more on that later, a survey on acute pancreatitis. And in news?
There is a report that's come out from the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre, and it looks at the trends in overdose and other drug-induced deaths in Australia from 2005 to 2024. And I think normally people would expect to see an increase in potentially all drug classes, but what's been quite astounding with this report is that stimulants, so things like methamphetamine, are contributing more to drug-induced deaths and hospital presentations.
Yeah, we should just say that, you know, between 2023 and 2024, overall drug-induced deaths went up by 7.4%. The dominant cause was unintentional drug overdose. And as you rightly say, the biggest increase was in amphetamines, in stimulant medications. It disproportionately affected males. Mm. And interestingly, you think this is a problem of younger people. The biggest age group was midlife, so 35 to 54, but even significant in 55 to 64-year-olds. So not necessarily what you think. Disadvantage was certainly a risk factor, but they also went through other risk factors for drug overdoses, which really go to people recognizing when somebody's at risk, personal history of self-harm, family disruption by separation or divorce, legal problems, disappearance or death of a person in your close group, problems with relationships with a spouse or partner, somebody who's not complying with or adhering to medical treatment, and so on. So these are very much the social circumstances of a person, and it starts to explain why it happens in midlife, because these are problems which tend to accumulate in midlife.
So opioids still remain the leading cause of overdose deaths. 40% increase in cocaine-related deaths, 29% increase in amphetamine-type stimulants. What I also wondered is how much of this is potentially from prescription medication and potentially diversion of medications that people might use for a condition like ADHD, because I see that in the consulting room.
And the place of death is really important, because this goes to ambulance services and so on. You might think, oh, because we've got this stigmatized view of drug use, that you think, oh, well, it's in a back street or a lane somewhere outside. 75% or so occur at home. This is sobering and public health issue that we just cannot ignore.
Cholesterol. There's a study that's been published in JAMA, which has looked at the global disease burden attributable to low-density lipoprotein, so LDL cholesterol, the one that tends to go and clog arteries and increase the risk of stroke and heart attack.
So it's called the Global Burden of Disease Study, where they're looking at risk factors, which they've been doing for many years. They are looking at LDL cholesterol. What's the burden of disease due to LDL cholesterol, which is the form of cholesterol that really does the harm? It's the cholesterol, form of cholesterol that takes cholesterol to the blood vessel, inside the wall of the blood vessel, causes inflammation, which starts that atherosclerotic process that can lead to stroke and heart attacks. And they're looking at the patterns around the world. And what's interesting about this study is rich countries, the impact of LDL tends to be falling because they have the resources and the drugs to treat it.
And the dietary interventions.
That's right. In poor countries, it's going up, particularly with increased exposure to ultra-processed foods. But interestingly, the report, and it doesn't really explain why, it's not gone up quite as much as they would have expected with the increased consumption of ultra-processed foods, but it's gone up nonetheless. And in middle-range countries like China and India, it's going up, and you know, they're clearly struggling to deal with this. So, look, the reason we're talking about it is that it's a global problem, and it just highlights the difference between rich and poor and middle-income nations, and not something to be ignored either.
And just to put this in context for people, in 2023, according to the study, high LDL caused 3.6 million deaths. So this is the important cholesterol. And also statins, which are the medication that we would use if you have a high LDL, if you're at high heart disease risk, they're still the cornerstone in managing that LDL cholesterol. But it says in the study that it's still being underused, even when it's available. And that's because people often have preconceived notions about the side effects. It might be barriers to accessing the medication, maybe income factors. But, you know, there is a medication out there that can actually treat this. It's still underused. That, to me, is baffling.
So one of the things we pride ourselves on in the health report is that we're right on the button. In fact, we're ahead of the button. For example, the Zoladex story with women and being denied the drug, we were weeks and weeks ahead of the rest of the media. So, you know, big tick to us, but we missed something big. There is an award called the L'Oreal UNESCO Women in Science International Award. It's huge. It recognises women's research in all sorts of areas. And the laureate for the Asia and Pacific this year was Professor Felice Jacka, who's well known to Health Report listeners for her work on food and mood. And we missed it. I'm sorry, Felice, for missing it.
Thank you for the apology, and thank you for the recognition now, Norman. I was saying earlier to someone that if I'd been a sports person, I probably would have been all over the news. But, you know, Australia doesn't always value science as much as it does sport.
And the science that you've been doing has been revolutionary in many ways, linking nutrition to mental health.
Well, that's right. So the award recognised my work establishing the field of nutritional psychiatry and all of that, the work that went into that. So the observational research, the trials, setting up the international society, establishing the Food and Mood Centre, you know, all of that sort of work that develops a whole platform and a whole field for further research and supports early career researchers to come into the area and to do their PhDs and to become scientists. So it was incredible honour, and I still to this day can't quite believe it. I keep pinching myself.
No, it's really exciting. And where to next for this research? What's next on the list, do you think, in terms of where this is going?
Well, it's really interesting because our Food and Mood Centre, of course, we've got about 50 really amazing people in the centre, and we're doing all sorts of work from trials in poo transplants, believe it or not, through to working with the Global Burden of Disease study to get the diet and depression link into that Global Burden of Disease so that policymakers can work out how much of that burden in their area they could potentially avert if they improved population eating habits. The work that I'm really focused on now personally is looking at how the planetary microbiome and the human microbiome interact, because our global food system, of course, is destroying soil, arable soil that's full of microbes. That's the main source of biodiversity on the planet. And all of our pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, et cetera, are destroying that microbiome. And we believe, based on the emerging evidence, that that's going to have huge implications for our health, and it's already doing so. So when we lose planetary microbiome, we lose human microbiome, and we believe that the two are very closely linked. So looking after the planet becomes good for our own personal health.
Indeed it does. Felice, thank you so much for joining us on the Health Report, and congratulations again.
Thank you so much, Norman. I really appreciate it.
And our new section, WTF.
Yes. We have something every week now. It's very exciting.
We do. There's no shortage of WTFs.
We need a jingle, I feel. We need something.
And we're on a mission also to find ones that don't actually involve the United States, because that's just easy pickings. So this one involves Australia.
This is Australia. This is related to B6, vitamin B6. Now, Health Report fans, loyal listeners will know that we have covered B6 in great detail before. This is the vitamin that you can take. It's often in multiple supplements. You don't know that it's necessarily in there, and there have been increasing reports of vitamin B6 toxicity, people having peripheral neuropathy, these nerve symptoms, these paresthesias, numbness, tingling, that often don't settle.
Some of which don't go away.
That's right. We covered it, and we covered the fact that there were TGA was putting in extra things to protect patients. So they were putting warnings on boxes saying, check that you're not taking B6 and multiple things. They're also going to make B6 products containing more than 50 milligrams a Schedule 3 medication. So you have to go and speak to the pharmacist. But Norman, remember you were very cross.
Not till mid-2027.
Thank you.
WTF.
WTF. So here's where things get really WTF. Study been published, Internal Medicine Journal from the University of Sydney, and they've tried to look at people's B6 buying habits. And the long and the short is people are still buying B6 products. They're often buying duplicate B6 products. And the takeaway really is that all these warnings from the TGA have done nothing to curb people from buying them.
And they make the comment that the extended implementation period of the scheduling, God knows why they're doing it, WTF. The researchers say this longer implementation period allows people to stockpile their vitamin B6 so that they can continue to damage their nerves long term.
So this is a reminder. Look, Norman and I don't take any extra supplements. Is that true, Swan Dog?
We haven't still changed. True. Yes. It is still true.
Just checking. And if you are taking supplements, check the back, because B6 might be in multiple products, and there have been reports of peripheral neuropathy at doses under 50 milligrams. So go and have a look.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report. All credit to you, Priya. This is a topic that we're just about to cover, which you have cared a lot about, both on the show and in your practice, which is the issue of, amazingly, people getting GLP-1s when they've got an eating disorder.
I guess what's happening is, and we tend to cover the very positive elements to these medications on the show with all the emerging research, and there are many. For some people, these medications are amazing. I see it in my consulting room, changes quality of life, big positive impacts. But I think clinically, a lot of people, dietitians, psychologists, GPs like myself, are starting to see some potential harms. And it's twofold, Norman. I think there are some people who are getting these medications and access to them who have no clear clinical indication. They just want to shed some kilograms. And that's where diet culture comes into it. And then there is an even darker side where there are vulnerable people with eating disorders who are accessing these medications to fuel and maintain the eating disorder.
And they're able to do it because they can access them relatively anonymously.
Yes, and really quite easily. And before we get into this, I just need to declare my conflict of interest, which is that I am a credentialed eating disorder clinician, and I'm also working with the National Eating Disorders Collaboration later in September in this space around treatment pathways.
The issue in particular is that if you have an eating disorder, say anorexia nervosa, and you want to take these GLP-1s, which are promoted heavily by social influencers, you can actually go to a telehealth clinic. Doctor doesn't see you. and get the drug.
Well, that's what we're seeing, that people can attain them quite easily. And even though we live in Australia where there's quite tight regulations around advertising, I don't know if you've seen on your social media feed, Norman, very innocuous advertising from weight loss clinics, which kind of talk about weight management, but it's promoting weight loss for all. And you can just click a link and head off and go and get yourself a GLP-1 medication quite easily.
So you've spoken to somebody who's been through this experience.
I spoke to Kate, which is not her real name, and she has a lived experience of an eating disorder. She has a diagnosis of anorexia nervosa, which she had been to hospital for.
So it's really on the severe end of anorexia nervosa from her point of view.
Yes, which can be a terminal illness with serious implications. So Kate had a history of anorexia nervosa. She then accessed a telehealth-only clinic to attain a GLP-1, and she did disclose that she lied about not having a regular GP. In fact, she had a regular treatment team with a GP, a dietitian, and a psychologist. But she was quite easily able to attain the medications, and she shares her story.
I knew I wouldn't be able to access it through my regular GP because I've been seeing her for the past almost 5 years now. So I researched it initially, and then I saw an ad pop up on my Instagram for an online GP telehealth service. And at the time, I think initial consults were like $30. I think they've increased to $50 now. They also now have separate fees for specifically weight loss medication, which is ridiculous. But I booked my initial consultation, and after that first appointment, it was almost criminally easy to access the medication. So I had told them that I was interested in taking the medication. I told them that I was overweight. I don't really look at my weight. I do blind weighs almost every week with my GP. I don't remember the last time I saw my weight with my GP, although there have been times I've seen it myself because I've just been curious. But yeah, I did respond falsely to what my weight was. And I made sure to say something that would classify me in the overweight range.
So you lied about your weight to attain the medication?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
And from that, they gave me a referral for a blood test. I got my blood test. Everything was fine. And the next follow-up appointment, they gave me the prescription for it almost straight away.
Did they screen you for an eating disorder? Were you asked, have you ever had an eating disorder? Do you count your calories? Do you weigh yourself?
No, not at all.
And did you get any kind of what we call wraparound care? Did someone say to you, look, you need to increase your protein intake, you need to engage in resistance training, see a dietitian, ideally exercise physiologist? Did you get all of that counselling?
Initially, no. But when I asked for a repeat script, I think a month later, to get the repeat script, I had kind of said, I don't think the medication is working. I think we need to increase the dose. And they basically said, okay, what has your weight done? And I told them that it may be changed by a few hundred grams. This was in March last year, so it was quite a long time ago. And they said that, okay, what training have you been doing? What are you eating? And I've always been a bit iffy with telling people what I'm eating, especially coming from a background with an eating disorder. And they basically said, you're eating the wrong things, you're eating too much, you need to do less cardio because it makes you more hungry and more like lower rep, higher weight resistance training. The gym part of it was fine, but hearing that specifically in terms of my food was quite jarring for the eating disorder. It also was quite abrupt, like it wasn't comforting advice, it was more like, no, you're doing the wrong thing. Like it was very forceful, which was also quite intimidating.
How easy was it, do you think, to get this medication with your history and all the potential risks for your bone health, your muscle health, your nutritional markers? I know you're probably an expert in all of this, your iron, your B12, your zinc, all of that. How easy was it?
It was criminally easy. Honestly, accessing it, I have trouble getting concerned for myself, but knowing how easy it was to access for me and knowing how many people struggle with an eating disorder, it actually made me scared at the same time.
If you or anyone you know needs help with an eating disorder, there are resources available. There's the Butterfly Foundation, which is on 1-800-334-673, 1-800-334-673. There's the National Eating Disorders Collaboration, and you can go to their website. And then, of course, there's Lifeline on 13 1114. We'll have those links in our show notes. So that's a salutary story. Now, we went to that particular telehealth clinic, put a few questions to them about why Kate wasn't properly screened, why they didn't seem to ask relevant questions, and why there was relatively poor follow-up. What was the answer we got, Priya?
We got an automated response, which was likely AI-driven from what we could tell. And it
You're
said,
kidding.
No. They said they'd check their records. We were not a patient of theirs. We emailed them again and they didn't answer our questions by the deadline. But it appeared that the response was AI-driven and not a person.
Extraordinary.
Hmm.
Now, we've been to APRA, which is the regulator here, and they wouldn't come on for an interview.
No.
They gave us a statement.
They did, and the full statement's in our show notes. But the takeaway really is that they are aware of the potential harms here and that they encourage practitioners should be responsible in their prescribing and that telehealth clinics may not be suitable for everything.
People need to complain to APRA if they've got experience of something like this. The volume of complaints needs to go up, but it's interesting that they wouldn't come on to give us an interview. And there's an open invitation to APRA to come onto the Health Report whenever they like. We will put them on and have an extended interview so we can hear their point of view. So you're listening to a special feature on GLP-1s and eating disorders and their access here on the Health Report on ABC Radio National.
I had this story in my mind, Norman, for quite a while. I did raise this with you a while ago from things I was seeing in the consulting room. And we did wait for a period of time, is that fair to say, because there wasn't any hard data on people with eating disorders or the misuse of GLP-1s. And in fact, there's been some research published in JAMA Psychiatry. It gives an insight into what is happening in the United States, and it is quite eye-opening. I spoke to two authors on the paper, Dr. Sherry Levinson and Dr. Nicholas Piper, who are both professors at the Eating Anxiety Treatment Laboratory at the University of Louisville.
In this interim analysis of 436 people, we found that about 1 in 3 reported lifetime use of a GLP-1 medication. This is about 2 times higher the rate that we have observed in the general population in the United States. So that was a really alarming finding to see such a higher prevalence. About 1 in 5 reported currently using one of these medications, and about 10% reported a form of misuse. So this could include tampering with the syringe. There's a specific dosage schedule that you're supposed to adhere to. So typically starting with a lower dose and then slowly titrating up, people are accelerating that schedule. And then they also indicated that they sometimes share their drugs with family or friends.
So people with eating disorders, because that's the population that you're recruiting for the study, people with eating disorders are actually using GLP-1 medications more often than the general population, just to be really clear from your study.
In this particular sample, yes.
So Sherry, I just wonder, can you just explain or talk us through what the potential harms are here of someone with an eating disorder accessing a GLP-1 medication? And people might have heard of some emerging research in binge eating disorders around potentially a positive role of GLP-1 medications, but I think we should clearly state that there's not enough research there, and we're certainly not prescribing it for that indication in Australia, and it wouldn't be standalone therapy, so there are a lot of caveats there. But can you just talk us through the potential harms? If someone who is restricting food has anorexia nervosa, atypical anorexia, they take this medication, what can happen?
We know that across all eating disorders, regardless of diagnosis, anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, binge eating disorder, atypical anorexia nervosa, we know that restriction is one of the primary reasons that people continue to develop and continue on with their eating disorder. So restriction is actually one of the really core behaviors of all eating disorders, and it also can cause people to develop eating disorders. It can cause people to relapse from eating disorders. And so any sort of medication that is enhancing restrictive behaviors is really, really risky for a population whose primary problematic behavior is restriction. Because essentially what these drugs are doing is mimicking appetite suppressant, restriction. It's helping people be able to eat less. And when you have folks who are very vulnerable, so people with eating disorders, this can just be really, really risky and maintain their eating disorder, make people sicker, and cause lots of impairment and medical complications.
Can I just pick up on something you said there, which is that the weight loss induced by these medications might actually precipitate an eating disorder? Because that is something that is starting to be more discussed, that someone living with overweight obesity might have a clear indication to go on the medication, but the weight loss itself can precipitate an eating disorder. Can you just pick that out for us?
Yeah, so we know that eating disorders are genetically based illnesses. So we know that certain people have genetic tendencies to develop eating disorders. And then when you add on restriction or rapid weight loss that comes from restriction, that's really what pulls the trigger and makes someone develop an eating disorder. What that means is that we are starting to hear about lots of folks across the country who did not have eating disorders, but went on a GLP-1, and now they have developed an eating disorder because of the restriction that was started by being on the GLP-1.
Nick, so this study looked at people with an eating disorder already. Do we have any idea from the study about how people are accessing this medication?
Yeah, so a core component of the study was looking at exposures to online marketing and advertisements. Although this study didn't include figures around that, we did find that it was very common that people are seeing advertisements for GLP-1 drugs on a variety of social media outlets, television. In the US, we are unique in that direct-to-consumer advertising is allowed. So people are already getting exposures to these sorts of advertisements, especially during dinner time, all throughout the day.
But someone's prescribing these medications for patients. So is there an issue with access here? Are health professionals not adequately screening people for eating disorders? How are people getting these medications? In Australia, we have telehealth-only clinics where someone can call up or do a video call, never have met the health professional before and attain a script. Mm-hmm. How are people attaining these medications? Because it's not the patient's fault. These are vulnerable individuals. They're being heavily marketed, as you just said, Nick, these products.
Yep.
So how are they attaining them? Where's the issue in terms of access?
In the United States, when these drugs became very popular about 3 or 4 years ago, that actually led to commercial shortages. And as a result of the commercial shortages, that led to compounding pharmacies being able to create compounded versions of GLP-1 medications. So those medications can be purchased online. There are online pharmacies that will have self-report assessments around weight and height that calculates BMI, other sorts of demographic information, but really the bar is pretty low in terms of what you have to report. And then essentially, once you've done that assessment, then you're mailed a product. And then there are also things called research peptides that carry the label of not being for human consumption, but those are actually available in online marketplaces as easy as any sort of online marketplace where you can add something to your cart, check out, put in your payment information, and then it's mailed to your home. In our study, we found that about 10% of our sample reported ever using a compounded drug. So that's definitely something that we're very concerned about, as well as the emergence of this gray market and the unknown risk environment that that creates, especially for high-risk populations like people with eating disorders.
We have that in the Australia too, actually, in terms of unregulated peptides. Retatrutide and Reta, we talk about it a lot on the show, which are causing serious issues in Australia as well. Sorry, go on, Sheree.
And I was just also going to add that in general, I think that if people are going to a doctor, it's very rare that the doctors are screening for eating disorders. I think the statistic for that is that within medical school, there's something like 45 minutes to an hour worth of training in eating disorders. And so when you talk to physicians, most are not screening for eating disorders or don't know how to screen for eating disorders. And that is something I think that we can do a better job of, making sure that prescribers know two, number one, assess for eating disorders, and number two, how to assess for eating disorders, especially when prescribing GLP-1s.
So what needs to change? Clearly, these medications are being widely used by people who are very vulnerable with eating disorders. They're causing more harm. This can impact their bone density, their cardiac health. It can, you know, we know anorexia nervosa can be a terminal illness. How do we better things here? Because some people actually need this medication, really benefit from
Absolutely.
It. But there are potential harms. So how do you ensure access for those who need it but protect people who are vulnerable? What's the solution?
There may need to be some sort of warning that medications are not researched enough for use for eating disorders and have potential to cause harm in eating disorders. And then finally, I think we need to do a better job of informed consent, because these are medications are being talked about like wonder drugs. And so we really need to be doing a better job of giving a balanced view on GLP-1s and making sure that people who are prescribed GLP-1s are given both sides, the benefits and the risks.
Dr. Sherry Levinson, Professor in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences, University of Louisville, and Dr. Nicholas Piper, Professor Epidemiology and Population Health and Chief Scientist at the University of Louisville.
I mean, the strong impression I get from all this, Priya, is that it's a bit of a mess. So it's a mess in the United States, and it looks as though it's a mess here.
Yes, I think you're correct. And I think we need to be very clear here that there isn't enough evidence, as Cherie said, for the use of these medications in binge eating disorder. And what we didn't include in the interview, Norman, was the potential implications for children in this setting. So I did ask Sherry, if someone goes on these kinds of medications, if there's sudden changes in weight, if you're suddenly a parent or caregiver and there's rapid weight loss and you're not eating the same meals with your children, does that have an impact?
Yes.
And it does. And she said it does. And that, you know, children as young as 9 are being diagnosed with eating disorders. So there are many flow-on effects of these medications.
So what do the local experts say?
So a very similar story, unfortunately, and I spoke to Sarah Trobe, who is a clinical psychologist and national director of the National Eating Disorder Collaboration, and I asked her if she was surprised to hear Kate's story.
Sadly, I wasn't surprised to hear that story. We are hearing other stories of similar nature, and it's horrific, and we would never want someone to be experiencing that, and we know that the eating disorder voice is seeking that. Anorexia would try and get access to a GLP-1. And I think we have to be really thinking about all of the people with an eating disorder as well, alongside Kate's experience. All people experiencing an eating disorder may be trying to access a GLP-1, maybe already prescribed a GLP-1, and how do we keep them safe in this process?
Where are we at in terms of access? Because this seems like a very easy process. She was not screened for an eating disorder. Serious potential harms. Where is the issue, Sarah, in terms of failures here? Is it that there are many telehealth services who kind of specialise in this and there's potentially a conflict of interest? They prescribe the med, they dispense it, they often don't ever meet the person face-to-face most of the time. Or is it that all clinicians just aren't screening for eating disorders adequately?
We know that for the most part, eating disorder screening isn't happening. And in lieu of being a really clear guideline to support clinical decision making, what we're trying to do is encouraging prescribing practitioners to embed eating disorder screening before you're prescribing a GLP-1, because we are facing a high-risk population. We are facing people with higher weight are straight away at high risk of developing an eating disorder because of factors like weight stigma, because of disordered eating, because of poor body image, etc., that is exacerbated by these messages that are kind of swirling around us in this period of really significant increases in GLP-1s. The other part of that, Priya, though, is around telehealth. Now, telehealth is an amazing part of our system. You know, it really allows people who can't see a practitioner in person to access healthcare. So we can't just wipe that out. But it's really important that GLP-1s is a significant medication, you know. And so we can't have like this low-touch model where people are having a phone call without adequate assessment, without citing the individual, and then no ongoing monitoring by by that person to ensure this person is safe. It has significant impacts on nutrition and all of the other social factors that come with eating. And so telehealth is not providing that at the moment.
In terms of advertising, and the researchers from the JAMA Psychiatry paper from the United States, which is, of course, an entirely different space when it comes to direct-to-consumer marketing of medications, in Australia, the Therapeutic Goods Administration last year cracked down, had some advertisements removed, released new social media guidelines in terms of how these kinds of medications can be advertised. But Sarah, I see on my feed all the time these companies just very evasively mentioning weight regulation, and I can see the brand and I can click on the link in the bio and quite easily attain the medication. And it really does feed the diet culture, you know, aspiration to thinness and all weight loss being good. Do you think, given all the harms we've just discussed, there needs to be more tightening of the regulations?
We're still seeing that as quite rife, that people's algorithms are being filled with it, and equally people are being offered in healthcare settings as well. So whatever messages people are getting about their bodies, that people are being encouraged to have smaller bodies, and so people are very easily still able to access prescriptions online via the phone. And so that's what we're really recommending to the government and talking to them about how we can create a safer space for assessment and prescribing. This is not to make it harder for people who need these medications to get them, but what we want is just safer prescribing by practitioners that are informed about GLP-1s and their usage, that are keeping up with the evidence and providing really good holistic care, which might include GLP-1s and other things, but not being prescribed by people that are working outside of the scope of their practice, that are not providing really good holistic care.
Dr. Sarah Trobe, clinical psychologist and national director of the National Eating Disorder Collaboration.
So at the moment, there's not much we can do about this. It seems to be open season.
Well, that's how, look, if I'm transparent, I think a lot of clinicians at the moment, I sometimes feel a bit superfluous. So I have people with no clear indication or perhaps a high risk, a previous history of an eating disorder, who ask me about this medication, and I do a lot of counselling and diet culture and unpack it and why the harms are too high and don't outweigh the benefits, and they can go and get it quite easily anyway.
And this direct-to-consumer advertising ban that we have in Australia is almost meaningless.
Superfluous.
Now with social influencers.
Correct. And these companies that can get around it with very subtle messaging. But the diet culture seeds are there and people are vulnerable, and the quest for thinness, Norman, has always been there. So I know these drugs are amazing for some. I've seen it in polymetabolic ovarian syndrome and fatty liver and patients living with overweight obesity who can now move more, reduce their chronic disease risk. But everything has good and bad, risk and benefit, and there are potential harms.
And on ABC Radio National, you're listening to The Health Report. Yeah, you can do these sort of Freudian word association things. If I were to say acute pancreatitis to you, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
Honestly, it's scorpion.
Scorpion
bites, yeah. I think I feel like I need to Google this to confirm, but I reckon every single person who's been to med school will go, yes, I remember that.
It wasn't a feature in Scottish medical schools, I have to say. There are much more mundane causes of acute pancreatitis.
I'm correct, though.
Too much beer in the pub.
Yeah. Well, there are more common causes, but I just remember we all talked about it, scorpion bites.
Indeed.
Yes.
Acute pancreatitis, we are joking. It's not a joking matter at all. The symptoms, maybe I should give Priya a bit of an exam here, but the symptoms are you tend to get upper abdominal pain, which goes through to your back, can be very severe. You can be really laid low with this. Really severe acute pancreatitis can end you up in hospital.
Yeah.
So it's a serious condition. It can augur more chronic problems with pancreatitis, with inflammation of the pancreas. The pancreas, just to remind people, is an organ at the back of your abdomen which does a couple of things. It produces enzymes,
insulin.
Produces insulin, that's true, into the bloodstream, but it also produces enzymes which go into your gut to help you digest protein. And those digestive enzymes are what gets released in inflammation of the pancreas and causes inflammation and pain in the pancreas itself. And in fact, in really severe form, you can increase your risk of diabetes because it destroys insulin-producing cells at the same time. So this is not a trivial condition. And various states around Australia have been doing surveys on acute pancreatitis because overseas they've noticed rises in acute pancreatitis rates. And the latest survey has come out of South Australia. And one of the senior researchers involved was George Barreto, professor of surgery in the College of Medicine and Public Health at Flinders University.
The most common causes include stones in the gallbladder that drop down into the bile duct. The end of the bile passage shares a common mouth with the mouth of the pancreas, and that's where problems can arise. And alcohol is another leading cause. Though steadily we are seeing across the world an increase in triglycerides in the blood, is another important cause. Now, there are other factors, including drugs and calcium levels in the blood and tumors that can also cause pancreatitis, but they're less common than gallstones and alcohol.
So tell me about this research you did.
What we intended to do was find out, what does acute pancreatitis look like in Australia? Who is most affected? What are the trends? What are the predominant underlying causes?
So what you found is that there's a rise in acute pancreatitis, particularly in young people. To what extent?
When you look at acute pancreatitis, traditionally, because gallstones were something that used to develop after the age of 40, we would see acute pancreatitis in slightly older age groups. But now we're seeing gallstones developing much earlier in life. You're seeing metabolic syndrome starting earlier in life. And so the elevation in triglycerides and the presence of gallstones in younger people are causing this paradigm shift from a much older population towards a younger population in the prime of their life.
So are you saying then that a higher incidence of obesity and abdominal fat as reflected by triglycerides and increasing the risk of gallstones, that's what you're seeing?
Our study didn't look at obesity per se, but we do know the background about obesity and metabolic syndrome being on the rise in the last few decades. And I think that would certainly be contributory to the development of gallstones and potentially the risk of acute pancreatitis.
The other thing that you found is that it's not just rising in younger people, but also younger people who are in wealthier areas, better educated and so on, which kind of goes against the traditional lifestyle thing of alcohol. And younger people are not drinking quite as much alcohol as they used to. And it's also that group tends not to have metabolic syndrome at the same rate as people coming from disadvantage. So what's going on there?
Yes, that was an interesting finding. It's certainly a concern, and it doesn't mean that it wasn't a problem when it was affecting low socioeconomic status. It's just, it's demonstrating a change in the picture, and we need to understand why, because there is an opportunity for us to intervene and potentially change that course for the better.
Last year, I did a Four Corners on early onset cancer. There's 10 different tumours going up in younger people. Pancreatic cancer is one of them, albeit at a lower level. Are these two phenomena linked?
So I have a special interest in early onset cancers, and we have in fact studied pancreatic cancer in this cohort as well. Literature has suggested that there were two potential links. One is that acute pancreatitis is a presenting symptom of pancreatic cancer. But then there was this other finding that I could never reconcile, that acute pancreatitis was potentially a cause for pancreatic cancer. And I could never explain it, nor could anyone else. But when we looked at our own data, what we find is that the minute we take out patients with chronic pancreatitis, which is a known risk factor for pancreatic cancer, the risk of acute pancreatitis disappears. And so what our data shows quite clearly is that acute pancreatitis is a presenting symptom of pancreatic cancer, albeit in a very low rate. It's just 1.2 to 1.3%. So it's quite low.
So apart from avoiding alcohol and fixing up the metabolic syndrome, in other words, your metabolic health, do we know anything else that prevents acute pancreatitis?
These are undoubtedly the most straightforward things that are within people's control. The other factors like abnormalities in the development of the pancreas or calcium levels in the blood or autoimmune disease, that's totally out of someone's control.
To what extent do the statistics in South Australia match the rest of Australia?
It's at the level of the rest of Australia. When we compare it to the Scandinavians, we are way higher. We are at the highest level that the United Kingdom would experience in certain regions.
So are we world leaders in acute pancreatitis?
In terms of suffering from it, yes, certainly it appears that way.
George, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
George Barreto, who's Professor of Surgery at the College of Medicine and Public Health at Flinders University in South Australia. What's in the mailbag, Priya?
We've had Sue write in relation to the story we did on the Alzheimer's blood test that's being widely discussed in Australia.
Yeah.
Where I felt like we gave quite a bit of context to that. I saw just, you know, between you and I and thousands of other
nobody
people.
Nobody else is listening. We were kind of, yeah.
But I did feel like, Norman, did you see lots of things written about it and people talking about it? And I thought, no, you were selling this as something that it's not.
Meaning that people were thinking that it was a screening test,
yes,
and a diagnosis. Yeah, I had people, you know, friends saying, well, maybe I should have it done. I thought, no. And certainly our interviewee who heads Neura was not suggesting you have it done.
No.
It's still to be tested as a diagnostic test in Australia if you've got symptoms.
So Sue has written in relation to that story and says, my husband was diagnosed in 2012 with Alzheimer's dementia. With attention to diet, exercise, social connection, we kept him relatively stable until 2023. Wow, he is now in care.
Well done.
Yes. Yeah. Amazing. I had that Alzheimer's weight on my shoulders for 10 years longer than I really needed to. Until someone can come up with a definitive cure, why would you want to know even a week before you had to?
And Noel writes in as well on the same issue.
And says, as I understand it, the assumption that amyloid is the cause of Alzheimer's has not been proven. I heard of a study of the brains of super-aged people after death. Amyloid plaques were present in the brains of highly intelligent 100-year-olds. Why test for something that is quite likely to be irrelevant? And Noel, you have tapped into Norman's great love, but they're not testing for amyloid. We should be clear.
No, no, this is not a test for amyloid. It's a test for the other protein that goes inside nerve cells. Beta amyloid collects outside nerve cells, and they're not looking for beta amyloid there. We had a bit of a testy interchange with Matthew on last week's health report.
Well,
I did. It'd go at me because I was saying that the drugs were pretty useless. And he was saying, well, they have some benefit and they're the first in a row. But you're right that the one of the criticisms of beta amyloid as a theory of the cause of Alzheimer's is that people without cognitive decline can have quite a lot of amyloid in your brain. And when you remove all the amyloid, these drugs are fantastic at removing amyloid. They're really good, but you get very small effects on the disease, even when you treat quite early. So it's something else. And I think really what Matthew was talking about last week is, you know, it's almost a proof of concept. You get a little bit of an effect from these monoclonal antibodies that remove amyloid. But what's really coming down the track is that they're now really focusing on other biochemical pathways, particularly this tau. If you treat this tau, could you actually change the course? If you treated both tau and amyloid, could you change the course of Alzheimer's disease? So I think that's the way of the future. I'm not sure that Matthew believes that yet another beta amyloid drug is going to be the answer here.
We also had an email on bird flu in humans, and Julie has written in saying, would you please have a look at H5N1 transmission to humans? Authorities keep insisting that humans are at low risk, and using US data, only one or two confirmed deaths to reassure the population. I'm very much a layperson, but WHO data seems to suggest otherwise.
So really, really important point. It's hard to generalise with H5N1 because you're quite right. In early on, when this form of bird flu started to appear, you got when it was transmitted from birds to humans, which it's not, and it doesn't spread at the moment, thankfully, from human to human. There was a high mortality rate, seemed to be very severe. And yet in the United States, when it spread particularly to cows and to dairy herds, people seem to get quite mild disease. So, for example, if I remember rightly, one dairy worker got a conjunctivitis from the flu, and it was only with testing that turned out to be H5N1. And I think there are one or two cases like that which didn't spread and seemed to be quite mild. But it does have the potential for high mortality rates. And we just need to be thankful at the moment that it's not spreading human to human. But it's interesting, Priya, that the Australian authorities do seem to be trying to keep mammals as much, yes, as possible away from birds.
So, yes, and in South Australia, people would have heard that the greater crested terns, the population of South Australia have been significantly impacted by H5N1. So really the advice is to also keep pets like dogs away from potentially sick birds or dead birds, because we're really trying to prevent that zoonotic jump, aren't we, from the bird to the other mammal and then eventually to us and then between humans.
There's been multiple jumps to mammals overseas, but we haven't yet seen it here. And just a bit of information from one listener about the pneumococcal vaccination.
Yes, which I can't believe we haven't covered. We're normally onto this, Norman, but someone writes in and says, "Hi, Priya and Norman, I haven't heard you mention it, but it might be worth informing your health report listeners that the age for pneumococcal vaccination changed last month from 70 and over to 65 and over. And yes, I've been and had mine. I'm banging on about it in the clinic and then we just haven't done it on here."
No. And there's a new pneumococcal vaccine, which has an influence on a wider range of the pneumococcal family, which is good. And it's just one injection. You don't have to have two, although you might have to have two, but when they discover that, I'm sure we'll still be on air telling you about the latest, and we'll make sure we do this time too. And another little tidbit on pneumococcal vaccine is that there's a little bit of information that the pneumococcal vaccine, like Shingrix, does seem to reduce the incidence of the chances of dementia.
Mm. Isn't that amazing?
It's truly extraordinary.
Yeah, it is.
The other one is influenza vaccine, and the other one is tetanus diphtheria vaccine.
Yeah. Oh, you've heard them all on the health report here.
You have. Well ahead of everybody else.
Yeah, this is true. Now, we do like your emails, please. So we haven't even covered the whole mailbox. There were other gold we're going to leave till next week. But please write to us. It's healthreport@abc.net.au.
And don't forget our sister podcast, What's That Rash? And this week, we just take a deep dive into ultra-processed foods. What do we mean when we refer to them? Are they all as risky as each other? What's the story? That's What's That Rash this week.
I won't see you next week because you're off gallivanting, but I'll be here. I'll hold the fort down. Don't worry.
Oh, you're such a heroic. I know. So
everyone's so relieved. Oh, she'll still be here.
Absolutely.
We'll see you in a couple of weeks, okay? Yeah, bring us back a present.
If people notice I'm back, we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.